It is November 22nd, 2015, according to that thing we call a calendar. And as I've noted many, many other times on many, many other shows, yeah, I would call it the Pope's work schedule. But either way, 52 years ago today, earlier in the day, obviously, because it is 8 p.m. on the East Coast where I am sitting, like I said, 52 years ago today in Dealey Plaza, November 22nd, 1963, the public execution of the 35th President of the United States, John F. Kennedy, occurred. Ever after, we have been treated to a varying array of conspiracy theories, not the least of which, theoretically, is the conspiracy of one. And anybody who's ever listened to my show, anybody who's ever tuned into the Ocelli Effect knows that I have this terrible habit of bringing it up no matter what topic I'm discussing, because I believe it is the day that this nation went for a terrible turn for the worst. The last legitimate president to hold the office, in my estimation, was John F. Kennedy, and I will argue with anybody who disagrees. We know this. And, by the way, this is live on American Freedom Radio on a Sunday. You heard the Ocelli Effect music at the top of the hour. It is not a replay, baby. This is the JFK special that I've been talking about, and I'm so happy to do it here on this weekend when we are attempting to raise funds for American Freedom Radio. So, if you're hearing the sound of my voice, if you're on your TuneIn app, your Fondle Slab of choice via your applicable application, or if you've decided to go to AmericanFreedomRadio.com and take a listen to what we're doing tonight, hit the donate button and keep this kind of thing on the air. This is a unique show tonight. My first guest is somebody that I don't get to hear very often. And I'll tell you something right now before we have any sort of disagreements, dissertations, problems, or anything else. I'll say this. His heart's in the right place. The Bush crime family, you've heard me discuss them several times, and the myriad of crimes that could be attributable to them. Many of them, many generations. And that's just the stuff that you know about already. Anyway, the guy who made the film JFK 2, The Bush Connection, which later evolved into something called Dark Legacy, is my first guest tonight, John Hanke. And also, I am joined by Carmine Savastano, my friend, the author of the book Two Princes and a King, which is due to be released rather shortly. So, like I said, a unique show that you won't get anywhere else. How are you doing tonight, John?
I'm doing great, Charles. How are you?
Well, you know, I got to tell you, it's kind of disheartening that 52 years and a couple of decades of my life dedicated to researching a pivotal event in American history, we still do not have the conclusive answers, in my estimation, as to the why and the who, as far as decapitating our government in broad daylight in Dallas in 1963. I'm sure you and I can both kind of agree on that particular point.
Well, no, let's start fighting right from the jump. I'm just absolutely floored that 52 years later, more just stunning evidence comes up. I've learned, I think, more in the last year than I may have learned in the previous 52. And, you know, there were some years where with a really, really intensive learning curve. But you're going to have Fetzer on, or somebody's going to have Fetzer on later. And Fetzer has been banging a tin plate and raising all the hell he could to get people to pay attention to the really minuscule evidence that he had put together to demonstrate that the Zapruder film was altered. And the first time that I heard him saying that, and the second time and the third time and on up for maybe the first 10 or even 20 times I heard him saying that, I said, yeah, okay, you know, the stuff that you have is mind-boggling, but it's mind really, it takes an enormous amount of focus and attention to be able to understand the points that you're making, and they seem like they're small points. He was, you know, talking about how lamps, and you have to have a visual on it to get the effect, but how the lampposts are curved, and there's other things showing that the film had been manipulated in different ways. But my response to that was, well, so what? Right? Why? Who cares if it was it is what we have. It shows a shot from the front. Who cares if it was manipulated? And then, you know, he kept bringing this up and put together a team. I don't know if people will mind me saying that, but Larry Rivera is one person that I can name, and there were a lot of people contributing to this effort. But Larry went back and rediscovered interviews that somebody else had done with all of the motorcycle cops. And all of the motorcycle cops say that the limousine slowed to less than 1 mile an hour for 20 seconds in front of the grassy knoll. That's not in the Zapruder film. And, you know, I got news for you. You're just getting started. Because, well, here's the question that I've been trying to get people to engage and have, without very much success, I don't think, which is, how the hell is it possible that they eliminated the limousine stop? And people who have seen my videos know that I do a good bit of animation. And, I get a lot of criticism for it because it's, you know, it's not my life's work. It's not my focus.
No, but highly entertaining what you did with your animation and everything else. And that's the thing. I'll tell you what. Even if you disagree with every single point that you made in the movies or whatever else, you can't say that there wasn't a bit of humor, there wasn't something visually interesting happening. And, I mean, even in your earliest cuts of the film, I got to grant you that. Your presentation to me is excellent. Like, I would love to have you involved. I know it's not your life's work, but I'm telling you right now, if I was doing a let me be blunt, if I was doing a smart ass presentation on the Kennedy assassination, you're one of the guys that I would put on retainer.
Right.
Okay. That's
I've taught high school in the inner cities of Los Angeles, and if you are not entertaining, you can take a hike. You know, if you can't manage it, you can't teach somebody until you get their attention.
Right.
But my point is that I have some experience with animation, and a lot of my animations use video as real pictures as background and real pictures as foreground, right? Images of people who I put into background sometimes. And the point was this, that looking at the Zapruder film, nobody, 52 years before anybody really noticed. And how is that possible? I mean, you have all these brilliant people, Mark Lane and Jim Mars and on, but I mean, those are two just stellar intellects and stellar observers who didn't put together in their conversations with witnesses who would make, you know, offhand remarks about the performance of the limousine. Nobody detected that the limousine had made a 20-second essentially stop in front of the grass.
No.
Well, hang on. Let me just finish the point, which is that.
Sure.
How? And I'm telling you, as someone with experience in doing that sort of thing, manipulating images, that I am appalled. I'm absolutely floored at the incredible artistry and perfection of the job that they did. And if somebody came to me and said, "We want you to do that," I'd say, "How long will it take you?" I would say, "Geez, I think it's going to take me 2 or 3 weeks to figure out how I want to approach it." And then, you know, give me a team of 100 guys and a couple and a long weekend, and maybe we'll manage to make it happen. Well, and before we start, let me go down there and shoot the street empty, and then shoot the scene again with a limousine going down it, and, you know, have all of this background preparation. Whereas changing the shot from the grassy knoll into a shot from behind, I could do that, and it's on my to-do list. I'm going to do that in my next video, I promise. I'm going to change that shot in order to demonstrate this point. But is everybody listening? Because you got to, tune in right now. They left in the shot from the grassy knoll, and they took out the limo stop. They could easily have turned the shot from the grassy knoll into a shot from behind, and they didn't. What? You know, they in leaving that in and then handing the film to Garrison, and, you know, they knew what Garrison was doing with it. I don't think Garrison knew that they knew that what he was doing with it, but there's no way. I mean, I had a copy of the Zapruder film many, many years ago that was a duplicate of a duplicate of a duplicate that came from Garrison. It originated with Garrison. But, and, you know, then you have Geraldo Rivera, who I don't, you know, I trust to be a purveyor of misinformation on behalf of the killers. I trust him, and he's putting out the Zapruder film out there in front of all of us. So they wanted us to get that message. And what's going on with that?
Well, look, before you get too far away from the point you're trying to make about the limo stop, let me introduce you to another idea here. The reason why a lawyer like Mark Lane, and believe me, I've got my issues with Mr. Lane, okay? You got to remember, I'm more of a I'm way outside of the box when it comes to a lot of things here, okay? I am not looking at anybody being a sacred cow in the JFK research community. I don't care who they are. You know, you've made your mistakes, all of you, as far as I'm concerned. And you need to be checked on it, and you need to continuously check your own conclusions, because the more we learn, you know, we need to adjust. Fact is this: when it comes to eyewitness testimony, you have all sorts of problems there. I know what you're saying about the cops, but here's the thing: there are changes that occur in memory. Okay, I'll give you a quick for instance. If you're ever in an automobile accident, you can account for a great many details that happened in a fraction of a second that would not normally be observable, okay, based on the fact that your adrenaline has now gone up and all these other things happen, and time appears to slow down in your memory. You can see things fly off the dashboard. You can recognize that the order in which you slammed up against your seatbelt, if you were wearing it, if you weren't wearing one, you might know exactly which part of your face hit the windshield first. Trust me, I know this from experience. Okay? Bottom line is this. When it comes to eyewitness testimony and timelines, it's not reliable. That's the first problem. The second problem is this. Looking at the Zapruder film as it stands, I am not somebody who believes that it has not been tampered with. I do believe it has been tampered with. However, the wholesale manufacture of the event and all of this kind of stuff is inconsistent with the rest of the evidence. The shot from the grassy knoll is not consistent even with the vaguely released and the bootleg set of autopsy photos and everything else that has come out. If you take them, put them together, okay, what you have is a picture of what makes a little more sense, which is a shot from the grassy knoll having missed, first of all, because we do have evidence of a bullet strike on the other side of the street, not just James Tague, who I had many an argument with because he wanted to tell me that Lyndon Johnson was the mastermind behind the assassination just before his death, and I had several conversations with him, you know, and over the years. All right. But the thing is this. You got a missed shot from the knoll, and what you actually have is evidence of a shot from the front, and I do mean the front, not the front side, not the side, but the front. Okay, you have evidence of a shot from the rear also, automatically proving that you have a conspiracy. If you take a look at the evidence as it exists and you don't even go to this extreme of saying that the eyewitnesses don't match with the film, you've got a case for conspiracy automatically.
May I add something, Chuck?
Yeah, please do, Carmine. Mm-hmm. I know I've been kind of leaving you alone and
oh, letting
John
fine.
Speak his piece, but yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. I also want to say on the the point of witness memory from some of the psychological guides that I've read and some of the scientific guides regarding the human mind is almost like ice in some instances. There are things, like you said, like the car accident, life-changing events that can be indelibly put in your mind, but most memories that are short-term don't necessarily get transferred to long-term memory, and when they do, they aren't necessarily the exact same style that they were originally. A color can change. A detail can shift. And in that, I think, is where a lot of the problems lie throughout both sides. Not only just people, I think conspiracy advocates and conspiracy skeptics who support the commission, both can have memory problems, and the witnesses' testimony do change over time. You know, there's plenty of examples. Reby, Dr. Boswell.
Custer is an extreme example of changing memories over time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I think we can attribute it to that, and the Zapruder film, I agree, too, that it's likely it has been manipulated, but we have to remember, too, it's been manipulated by both sides. There aren't many primary copies of the film available, so it's a copy you've taken from someone else that could have been manipulated, like, for instance, with the Grodin scoping, you know?
There's the Grodin scoping, there's the misplacing of frames, there's been a whole lot of distortion of the film over time in the reproduction. But even in its most original form, if you go today and get a forensic copy from the National Archives, which is a pain in the ass, by the way, and costs a lot of money, if you do that, by the way, John, have you ever done that?
No.
No. If you go and get a forensic copy of what is allegedly the original, okay, you still have a very messy piece of work. This is not something, and no matter how it's been enhanced, no matter how many times, even Time Life, when they turned around and did you know, their different transpositions of the film, there was what was it? Boy, I can't remember who it was that put out the digitally remastered version where they reshot it frame by frame, but they even screwed it up, putting frames out of order and all kinds of other things. So the representations that have made it out to the public, there's all sorts of disastrous problems. I mean, for years and years, William Cooper tried to tell us that the Secret Service agent in the sitting in the driver's seat shot Kennedy in the face. And that's a wholly ridiculous proposition. If you have anything resembling something close to the alleged original, you will not see that happen. Okay, but if you have blurry things and you have all these different, you know, manipulations of memory also that have occurred. I mean, there are plenty of people that lived that day in Dallas that swear up and down that they saw the assassination happen live on television when there is no broadcast record of anything resembling that motorcade going and making that turn onto Elm Street existing in any television archive. But back to the point about the eyewitnesses, and the reason why I brought up Mark Lane is because he is quite used to challenging, cross-examining individuals. He's well aware that memory is one of those things that can be seized upon by a skillful lawyer, okay, here I am giving him credit, a skillful lawyer, to make their point or to destroy another one's point, regardless of the actual efficacy of the memory. So the problem here, when you have these stretches of time, and you can observe in that film and in other films a very near stop because there was a jamming on of the brakes. You can observe that. I mean, I know you've seen that, right, John?
Yes, certainly.
Okay. So, I mean, just taking a look at the film and saying to yourself, well, you know, but the limo stop thing, to me, it's a big waste of time because even if you take the film as it stands, you have something that proves conspiracy beyond a shadow of a doubt if you apply modern forensic ideas to what you're able to observe. If you take a look at even the bootleg copy of the autopsy photos, and I don't mean the digital representations that have been circulated all over the internet, but if you actually look at something made from the Fox set, which I have, okay, I possess them, I've blown them up, I've worked with them, a whole lot of detail that, you know, we can't see in your movies, John, when you show the autopsy films. I mean, I can literally look at the texture of the tiles on the original Fox set, all right, on the wall. You know what I'm talking about?
Do you want me to talk about something?
Oh, absolutely. I'm just going through this and saying to myself, you know, there's more than one way to look at that limo stop and the Zapruder film and everything else. And
Don't we talk about that?
Yeah. Okay, go ahead.
Well, no, I mean, I don't mind if you talk about it, but let's, rather than rattling on and on and on about this and that and the other thing, we have four policemen who say that the limo came to a 20-second stop in front of the grassy knoll. You talk about that.
Right. I just did by explaining that memory and the memory even from the police officers is in conflict with each other.
No, they're not. They're in agreement on that point. It's rather striking.
How many officers have you spoken to yourself?
They are recorded. I don't remember the name of the guy who did it. The guy, Larry Rivera, if anybody wants to Google it, is the guy who has done the most work on this. But he got his hands on the original recordings of the interviews with these four police officers.
Conducted by whom?
I don't remember.
I see. All right. Well, I can't speak to what it is that he's sourcing, right? What I'm able to do is tell you that I've spoken to some of those police officers, not very many of the motorcycle cops, but a guy that I marked in my files for many years is Stephen Ellis, who is one of those people that is often brought up in this discussion, and people would mark him as Stavis Ellis.
Did you ask him whether the limousine came to a stop?
I asked him what happened altogether, and he never mentioned the limousine stopping. You know, I just asked him to tell me what it was, his impression. Just tell me from point A to point B when that limo disappeared under the triple overpass, what happened? And independently, he did not reveal a stop in the limousine. Now, that's only my interview, and hey, other people may have interviews that conflict with what I was able to get from him, but I don't know what to say there. I simply asked him to tell me the story. Tell me what you observed. What did you see of significance? I have an idea that he might have told me if he saw a limo stop that he would have said, I saw the limo stop. But that wasn't what happened. It rolled very, very slow. He noticed a change in the motorcade's, like flowing motion. I forget the exact quote, but basically it was moving kind of smoothly, and then there was an abrupt sort of going back through the motorcade, slowing up of everybody that happened, but not a stop.
Well, the police were unanimous that it did not stop. It slowed to about 1 mile an hour for 20 seconds. Mm-hmm. One of the cops describes having to make circles with his motorcycle in order to not fall over, and also describes while he's telling that story about that they'd heard shots, and he was personally worried about getting hit. Anyway, so it sounds like you don't credit these policemen telling the story. And in any case, that wasn't the point. The point was that if they altered the Zapruder film in order to hide what these four police officers described, that is a very, very challenging something to attempt. And if you study Larry Rivera's work, there's lots and lots of other small details that they look at. For example, there's one picture of the limousine where you can see up until one point you can see reflections in the shining polish of the limousine, and then at one point there's a motorcycle cop and there's the limousine and there's no reflection of the cop in the limousine. And Larry points to that and says, well, this is more evidence that the film was altered, because you should see, not a clear reflection, but something that if you know what you're looking for, that you can tell that this is a motorcycle cop who's being reflected in the polish of the limousine. And then any number of other smaller points. Anyway, you credit it or you don't, and I credit it, but it brings me back to this story, and I think that it's interesting that eliminating the slowing, let us say, of the limousine, and geez, there's a quote. Jackie Kennedy refused to talk to Greer, the driver. Greer tried to apologize to her, and she refused to communicate with him, a number of smaller details like that. In the movie JFK, I never made anything of it until I heard this story, saw this evidence that Larry Rivera and others have put together. In the movie JFK, one of the witnesses says, I don't know what that driver was thinking. The movie doesn't try to make anything of that, but why, based on the Zapruder film that we've seen, why would anybody make that remark? You have said that there's pictures, you can see that the taillights are on in the pictures, but you don't see that in the Zapruder film. There's no indication that the brakes are on in the Zapruder film, but there are, I think, more than one. I think there's a number of photographs that indicate that the taillights are on. In fact, there's a moving picture taken from the opposite side, and I saw something in which you can see the taillight come on in that one. So that's, in fact, the taillight coming on is in the Knicks film. But you don't see it reflected in the speed of the limousine. The limousine moves very, very closely and smoothly. And the point that I was making is that after 52 years, my curiosity is at an all-time high. That the question, and I haven't been able to get you to address it either. I haven't so far been able to get anybody in the JFK research community to address the question of why, if you had the capability, the talent, and the knowledge and ability to eliminate a limousine slowdown, a 20-second near stop of the limousine in front of the grassy knoll, if you had those skills, why would you not also turn the shot from the front into a shot from the school book depository?
Well, right. Your point is you would eradicate all signs of conspiracy and make sure that it's just pointed at Oswald and be done with it if you had that capability. That is exactly
why
the point I'm addressing.
Why didn't they do it?
because nobody removed that limo stop in the first place. You can actually observe on a very clear copy of the Zapruder film. I've had it projected and in life size. You can see those lights come on in the Zapruder film as well.
But you can't see the limo slow down.
Because you don't have a realistic motion in the rate on that film. That's the truth.
You can, and
look at it.
Excuse me, you can do this. Excuse me for interrupting. But you can, and I have, gone through the Zapruder film frame by frame and counted by watching the changes in the background, right? There's witnesses standing on the grass, in the green grass median strip in the middle of the street, and you can watch the motion of those witnesses frame by frame, and it's very, very regular, and there's no indication of any slowing. I've done it, you know, counting it by the feet. I've done it, and there's no change.
Chuck?
Yes?
I would like to add that it's fine, but once again, unless it's a primary copy, it could be manipulated.
There are no primary copies.
Well, there are no primary copies.
Well, hang on. You know, look, you guys had me on. Let me talk for a second. There's
Let you talk. Now, that's not fair. I have been letting you talk. I mean, that's...
You're not letting me talk now. Look, there's a guy who worked for the Assassination Records Review Board. You familiar? Inside the Assassination Records Review Board.
You're going to talk about Doug Horn now. Yeah,
thanks.
Who he is, yes.
Okay. Doug Horn, you can find it easily on YouTube. He went and interviewed the guy who was the chief analyst at the CIA labs. I don't remember whether they're in Washington or whether they're in somewhere in New York. They might be in Buffalo. And it doesn't, you know, I don't know how that any, where the location of it is particularly relevant, but this
Hawkeye guy works at Rochester.
Okay,
yes.
There he is. All right. So, this, are you familiar with this interview that...
Completely.
And he describes seeing a huge red bloody streak coming out of Kennedy's head. And the Secret Service men, he describes how the Secret Service men in the room gasped, which gave him the impression that he talks about that they had not seen the film before. And they were all, you know, moved one way and another at the sight of this giant spray of blood and brains coming out of Kennedy's head. But you won't find a copy of the Zapruder film that has that.
Mm-hmm.
And he's looking at this early in the evening, or maybe it might be late in the evening on Friday. But I think that I'm willing to concede that it's very unlikely that there was much alteration done before he saw the film. And his description of it suggests that what he was looking at was an original. And he has a long and detailed conversation with Horn about that. And I'm persuaded that he was looking at an original copy of the Zapruder film. And that's not what you're seeing. You can't find a copy of that Zapruder film. So I don't think there can be any question that the Zapruder film was altered. That bloody streak has been removed.
Not objecting to the idea that it's been altered, not at all. And factually, have you ever in your own experiences seen a Zapruder film that hasn't been stabilized?
I don't know. Anyway.
Okay.
So would you
in its original form, it's not stabilized either. That's all I'm telling you.
I'm not interested in whether it's stabilized or not. I'm trying to get us to look at bigger questions, like why didn't they change the shot to a shot from the rear? If they altered the film to eliminate the bloody streak, why didn't they alter the film to eliminate the shot from the front and make it a shot from the rear?
Right. Your very valid question is actually exactly perfect. You know what? That's the point. If they were going to go through all this trouble of having the CIA tamper with it, recreate it, all these other different accusations of what happened to it, why did we not just simply eliminate all of the evidence of conspiracy which is present there? Why not? All that great capability, that movie magic, they didn't eliminate the idea that there is clearly two shooters from just what you're looking at.
So you want me to give you a few minutes to chew on that one before you come up with a response? And you might not come up with one. I have one, although I've had a lot longer to think about it than you, and I'm not sure that you'll like my answer. But
love to hear it. Love to hear
well,
it, actually.
I have another question. Let me feed you this question, and we'll come back to that one, which is, the limo stop referred to by these four police officers who I regard as extremely expert witnesses, right? I think that the police are trained, right, to be witnesses. They're trained to look at details. They're trained to remember details. It's, you know, it's part of their day-to-day job. And, you know, I taught high school in Los Angeles for 30 years, and if you ask me educational questions, you're liable to find that I'm quite attuned to those because it's my training. Anyway, the limo slowing to a few miles an hour in, for an extended period in front of the grassy knoll indicates that the Secret Service was very, very much involved in the assassination. And there's a lot of other evidence to suggest that as well. I mean, the fact that there were no people, no men riding on the back of the limousine as they entered Dealey Plaza, and on and on, right? There's any number of other pieces of evidence to suggest that the Secret Service was involved. But if you have that level of involvement of the Secret Service, why didn't they just poison Kennedy? It would have been so easy for them to change one of the syringe bottles in one of Kennedy's doctor's black bags. You know, what's James Douglas has written this fabulous, brilliant piece of work, JFK and the Unspeakable. And in that, it's just moving the detail that he goes into on the number of shots that, of one kind and another, that Kennedy is getting because of his Addison's disease and a number of other ailments that he was suffering from. But it would have been so remarkably easy to have sabotaged one of those bottles so that it was one of the doctors who administered a lethal dose of one thing or another to Kennedy. Why didn't they do that?
Which would have also guaranteed a cover-up because nobody wanted anybody to know that he had Addison's disease. Even at the HSCA, the doctors didn't want to discuss the condition of his
Don't run off down the street chasing Addison's disease. Look at the question and try to answer it. Why didn't they poison him?
I think another answer
exactly
possibly.
Right.
Oh, I'm sorry, Chuck. Do you mind if I?
Well, I just want to throw one thing in, and then please go ahead, and then I want to make sure that John gets more time to talk. It is an excellent question, John, an excellent and very logical question, and that is one of the things I appreciate about you, is that, you know what, when you start talking about, you know, gang mentality and how you got to murder in order to be trusted and things like that, beautiful. Never heard anybody make that analogy, and you're absolutely correct. Let me tell you something, though. The problem here with Secret Service being involved in the assassination, they are involved by their lack of doing their jobs correctly. They're drunk the night before. The only guy who wasn't hungover enough that he didn't move was clearly, you know, our friend Clint, all right, who makes the actual attempt to do something. Nobody else moves. All right, and meanwhile, you got everybody hungover, and hey, it doesn't really matter. We let the firemen watch them the night before in Fort Worth and everything else, right? Isn't that beautiful? Secret Service complicity in that they didn't do their jobs? No argument from me whatsoever.
Negligence might be a better word.
Negligence is a perfect word.
No, I don't. I disagree. That is to say, I think that the slowing of the limousine for this extended period in front of the grassy knoll indicates that it was not negligence.
But that's just your interpretation. Based on the facts and the evidence, it was that they were drinking, that they weren't paying attention. You know, people have made the allegation that the Secret Service are complicit, but it makes no sense because it's too big of a group. You're going to get caught or you're going to get betrayed if you have anything larger than a small compartmentalized force. More than a handful of people, someone's going to talk.
Is that a fact?
I would imagine in any major – I mean, I too have studied some intelligence operations in the Central Intelligence Agency, and they do use small groups for infiltrations. They do use small groups for assassinations. Since the 1955 assassination guide was written, that was what was always suggested, was a small group with rifles from under 200 yards.
And what's a small group?
A small group, in my opinion – now, you know, maybe we have different – definitions for what small is, I and the people who wrote the original assassination guide, but a small group would include, actually it says to only have one person who sort of fulfills the Oswald role to blame everything on, that he has no connection to the rest of the organization, and the organization should be a limited amount of people, nothing should be kept on paper. I think that that sounds a lot more feasible than the entire Secret Service, which is dozens of people, were all complicit to kill Kennedy, and if they were complicit, I think they would go with your idea, John, of poison, because that could be easily swept under the rug rather than a public murder.
Well, and it would only take one or two people.
That's true,
and,
too.
And I'm rather inclined to agree that the point that certainly you would think – that if you were going to conspire to do anything, you would try to develop a plan that required the participation, the direct and knowledgeable participation of the smallest number of people possible.
Mm-hmm. At that point, I think all three of us can agree that it would be...
Then why not poison him rather than this gangland-style murder in front of hundreds of witnesses?
Well, right. And I agree with that, too. I think that... It was, in some ways, that's why I think that complicity, in my opinion, could fall on either people who were trained by the CIA, be it the Cuban exiles or the mafia. It could fall on people within the CIA or a rogue element operating within the CIA, but a smaller one. I just don't think it can be – a lot of people want to attribute it to an entire organization, and I think that's too many people.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Well, as a matter of fact, but I'm going to return to the – I would love to come back to this question of the CIA.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think that the number of agents that were in the limousine behind Kennedy is so large that it's beyond belief that those men were all involved in a conspiracy. One. Secondly, the only people who had to be involved in the conspiracy would be the driver and his boss in the limousine behind, I think. That the gentleman who, and you guys probably know his name, it sounds like, who waved the people off of the back of Kennedy's limousine, right? So the rest of the agents...
Emery Roberts.
Okay, very good. The rest of the agents on the scene wouldn't have to... They might be scratching their heads and saying, geez, what the hell's going on? But they wouldn't necessarily have to have been involved. So why didn't they poison him? And my answer to that question... is that the reason that they poisoned him is that the reason that they killed him was to send a message to every future president saying, mess with us and we'll kill you. And just in case you don't believe that threat, let us let you see a copy of the Zapruder film. Bill Hicks used to make the joke that every president, when he's sworn in, immediately gets to see a version of the Zapruder film that was shot from the grassy knoll. Which is, you know, it's a good joke, and it's a solid point. However, I'm persuaded that Abraham Zapruder, and I don't want to get away from this point about the CIA, but Abraham Zapruder. I mean, I've wondered about Abraham Zapruder, and you guys probably know that Abraham Zapruder's wife worked at the same business that DeMorenschild's wife worked at, which is pretty thin in terms of evidence. But Abraham Zapruder took that film and then he immediately handed it to the Secret Service. He didn't hand it to the FBI, which would have been the logical choice. He handed it to the Secret Service, which is rather extraordinary. And we know what the Secret Service did. They flew it into Hawkeye Labs, among others. And at the time, anyway, we won't go into all of that. But that's a worthy but long discussion. Hang on.
Yes.
Zapruder then got taken to a television station where he sat down, and you can find this on the internet without, you know, too much trouble. It's on YouTube. And he describes on television for the viewing audience how Kennedy's brains spilled out of his forehead when he was shot from the rear. Zapruder was in on it.
Well, it seems to me as though Zapruder was pointing to the side of his head and using his hand to show the avulsion of the side of his head, which I always found strange in and of itself.
He certainly didn't put his hand to the back of his head and describe an explosion coming out the back of Kennedy's head, which, but we don't need to quibble about exactly what it was that he said, but he did not. We can agree that he did not describe what he had seen. And so, my conclusion is that they prepared, they were ready, that they had people. Zapruder was there under direction. He handed that film over to the person he was supposed to under direction, and they immediately had it duplicated and handed off to the people who were then going to make the copies. But like I'm saying, I believe, I agree with Garrison on this one. When people ask Garrison, and I think that Garrison, until he talked to Prouty, and let's touch on that for a second, when... Garrison early on suspected Lyndon Johnson, and then he ran into Prouty. And Prouty is the guy who wrote National Security Memorandum 263 with John Kennedy, and they ran through several drafts. He and Kennedy worked very, very closely in writing 263, and Prouty, you can find Prouty talking about it also on YouTube in enormous detail. But the point is, he was very, very, Prouty was very, very centrally located, and he didn't get fired the day of the Kennedy assassination. He continued to maintain a very high position and, you know, was in and out of the White House and was very, very close to those doings. And it was Prouty's opinion, and very, very forceful, that Johnson was not involved in the assassination, and he persuaded Garrison. And what Garrison, you can find Garrison saying, is that Johnson wasn't involved. He didn't need to be involved because he heard the shots. And it took me a while to figure out what Garrison is saying when he says he heard the shots. And what he means is that he understood clearly that the same people who had murdered Kennedy were going to murder him if he didn't do what he was supposed to do. And
Right. And this is the assertions that Johnson is the mastermind are completely ridiculous when you realize that he's asking Hoover if any of those shots were aimed at him, you know, on a telephone call that would have never made it to public, you know, to the public arena at that time. You know, come on.
These conversations with Senator Russell, where Senator Russell and him both disputed the single bullet theory, but they didn't do it publicly, of course, but in private, they disputed the single bullet theory and realized there might be two shooters.
And Johnson recorded those conversations and put them in his library for us to get our hands on. Oh, listen, I don't mean to dominate, and I have a point that I want to make, and if somebody else wants to say something.
Okay.
Okay, so you've all read JFK and the Unspeakable, I trust.
I have.
And I had to have this brought to my attention and go back and say, God, How could I have read past this story? But it's there. I'm sorry I can't quote you chapter and verse. Look for it. And you look in the index for Hoover and you'll find it. The morning after the assassination, 9 o'clock in the morning, Johnson has been president for 2 seconds. And he picks up the phone and it's McCone, the head of the Central Intelligence Agency. And the head of the Central Intelligence Agency says, we, the CIA, he was the head of the CIA, appointed by Kennedy, have a audio tape of a phone conversation of Lee Harvey Oswald at the Cuban embassy in Mexico City talking to the Russians, and he's talking to a Russian assassination expert. This is the smoking gun. The Russians are involved in this, and Johnson says, oh, my gosh, World War III, what are we going to do? And McCone says, yeah, this is really, really hairy stuff, isn't it? Click, hang up the phone. A few minutes later, Hoover calls, and Hoover says, I have the tape. It's not Oswald. My men have been interviewing. They interviewed Oswald all afternoon and all evening, and then they got on a plane at midnight and flew in here, and they've been listening to the tape for the last several hours, and they are emphatic beyond any question. That is not Oswald. The tape that the CIA is trying to hand you and start World War III, or at least an invasion of Cuba, is a fraud.
Mm-hmm. I think we all might agree on that too. That the CIA did hand misinformation and perhaps in some cases disinformation to other officials in order to try to keep their compartmentalized missions they had going down in Mexico City away from their knowledge. I think I agree with you that yes, a lot of things were suppressed. I mean, from the Politico article that came out and from plenty of other articles, we know there was a cover-up. I mean, anyone who will not admit at this point that there was a cover-up has not read the files.
And forget the articles. You know what? If you take a look at the memorandums where Hoover writes in his own hand that he knows he's been snowed by the CIA, yeah, that exists, by the way. Yeah. Hoover saying that he knows he's been fed disinformation over this issue. Okay.
So that kind of takes Hoover out of the conspiracy, does it not?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I think he did have a lot of illegal plans, though, like COINTELPRO, he didn't want people to find out about, so I think that's why he helped out.
Oh, no, listen, always happy to help the cover-up because he had no use for the Kennedys, and hey, look, they're out of the way. I'm in a better spot now. Good deal.
Lifetime appointment from Lyndon Johnson, only one outside of the Supreme Court.
There you go. Okay. You know, back to the Secret Service thing from earlier, though, John, because I patiently waited for you to go through
sure.
that. I want you to wrap your mind around something here when you say, well, it only required the guy driving and the people in the limo and the guy behind him. No, No good. The problem here is that you have an advanced team. You have a whole lot of other people that had to have dropped the ball here regarding the Secret Service coverage. It requires a larger amount of people that are not doing their jobs than just that one supervisor, the guy who was in charge of that leg of the trip, who was in the passenger seat, by the way, of the infamous limo, and Emory Roberts. You need a whole lot more, because the ball was dropped all over the place, John.
Well, I think your point would be they had a whole lot more, and I don't dispute that at all. I think that every Secret Service man probably certainly in Dealey Plaza was part of the conspiracy to murder. That would be my guess.
You think Clint Hill, too?
Oh, absolutely. There are photographs of Clint Hill on the back of John Kennedy's limousine as it is churning into Dealey Plaza. He abandoned that position as the motorcade, as the limousine moved into Dealey Plaza.
But Hill is one of the four that was drinking. That is confirmed to have been drinking.
Okay, all right.
I'm not saying that, you know, it is beyond the possibility that a member or two here and there could have been involved. I just think that for it to be – I think a lot of them screwed up enough on their own without necessarily being complicit.
Okay. And, these are – to me, they're relatively minor details, and there's certainly nothing to fight about.
Yeah, we agree overall. Yeah.
Wait a second. We've only got about 10 minutes left, right?
And
I know we've meandered down some paths you didn't expect to go down. I'll tell you what. Let me let you change the direction of the show right here with the last 10 minutes and tell us what you think is the key, the thing that people need to know. I mean, we're talking about 52 years later, and we're still stuck without definitive answers and even really truly a set of definitive evidence to tell us exactly what occurred here, in my estimation. That's my assertion. But you know what? 52 years later, we're still debating this whole situation. Okay. I wonder where you want to take it as far as what is the key thing that you think people need to know.
I think the key thing, and I can say this in 30 seconds and then go down the other road that I was aiming at, is
sure.
that this was a right-wing coup. And Lyndon Johnson passed Medicare. Jeb Bush wants to repeal Medicare. Medicare is such a bug up the butt of the right wing that 52 years later they're anxious to repeal Medicare. They can't stand that old people can get medical care. That's a very thoroughly right-wing position. And you'll get this. You know, Fidel Castro and his people had the CIA as infiltrated as they could, and rather well infiltrated. And, you know, I'll throw out for an example that Fabian Escalante, and he's written a couple of books, and I recommend them, says that his information was that the mafia funded the assassination, that they handed the CIA $50 million to make the payoffs to all of these people who were, you know, and if you were involved in the least or the most tangential way, the most distant way, you got paid off handsomely. And they did that with $50 million that they got from the mafia. But let's get back to Lyndon Johnson and J. Edgar Hoover sitting there, because this one's going to turn your mind around, I think. And they're looking at this conspiracy, this right-wing conspiracy, to portray Oswald, who I believe was an agent that was in very direct communication with Hoover. But we don't need to get into that, and it's not the essential point. They're looking at this tape from Mexico City, from the highest people in Mexico City, right? These are not low-level operatives producing this tape. It's probably David Attlee Phillips, the head of the Mexico station, that's handing them this tape. And it's a fraud, and it's a fraud that's aimed at setting Oswald up to look like an agent of the Cubans and the Russians. And you have to remember the phone call before, right? Johnson's talking to McCone, and McCone is saying, World War III, right? And Johnson is saying, yeah, oh, my God, what are we going to do? And then Hoover gets him off the hook. I don't say that as part of the conspiracy, but Hoover says, look, this tape is a fraud. There's a massive but Castro gave a speech the day after the assassination that's just stunning. You're going to look a while to find it. I think the Ratville, I think that's where I found it. But, you know, he had the speech was written by the KGB, but they had all, you know, just a massive amount of research showing the AP is telling this lie, United Press is telling this lie, and, you know, some other news source is telling this lie, and also all of these things pointed at depicting Oswald as being an employee of the Cubans and the Russians, and Castro saying that this is a right-wing conspiracy. It's a right-wing conspiracy that is aimed at getting Cuba destroyed. I don't know that they invoked World War III so quickly, but now look, I assume that people will be familiar with this. Garrison had the bright idea one day saying, well, wait a minute, the Dallas police are fiercely competent. They probably arrested a bunch of shooters. And he went down and said, I want the arrest records of everybody who was arrested that day, right? The three bums, one of whom E. Howard Hunt's son looked at a picture of and had a visceral response saying, that's my dad. And on and on and on. That there's a mountain of evidence that I rely on in saying that I believe that Hunt was the Knoll shooter. But skip that, and we don't want to fight about it. The point is, any number of people got arrested as shooters or as persons of interest in the murder of the president and got walked over to the police station and then walked out the back. And the next day, the next morning, Hoover is talking to Johnson and he's got nobody in hand. He knows that the CIA was involved. He's got this freaking tape that's a fraud. Well, clearly the people who gave the orders to create that tape, framing Oswald as a tool of the Russians and the Cubans, clearly the person who gave that order, the origin of that order, is somebody who was involved in the conspiracy to murder. But Hoover doesn't know who it is. He doesn't know the name of the person who gave that order. He doesn't know the name, and neither does Johnson. And they don't know the names of any of the men who were arrested with guns in their hands. They know Hoover called George H.W. Bush into headquarters in Washington, D.C. Bush got called in for questioning. Marita Lorenz got called in for questioning. Jerry Hemmings got called in for questioning. And Marita Lorenz tries to tell the FBI agents about how there was these two station wagons full of men and guns who showed up in Dallas, and they didn't want to hear about it. They knew all that stuff. Oh, we know all that stuff. We know all that stuff, but we don't know that any of them were shooters. We don't have any information that will allow us to hang them as shooters. So Johnson is faced with this huge push that he knows is backed by massively powerful people who have infinite control over the media, who are trying to create Oswald as an agent of the Russians and force Johnson to invade Cuba and probably start World War III as a result. And that's why he forms the Warren Commission. Now watch this. He forms the Warren Commission and he puts Alan Dulles, who he suspects is being a prime mover in the assassination, and he puts John McCloy, who he ought to suspect as having been a prime mover in the assassination. He puts them on the Warren Commission and he says, you guys are going to sign this document saying that all of your work setting Oswald up to appear to be a Russian operative or a Cuban operative is a lie, that it's bunk, and we're going to hand this to the American people and we ain't going to have any damn invasion of Cuba.
Well, John, you know, I've let you go through all this. I really would love to do a series of shows with you and dissect that statement you just made, because the foundation of a great many of these things that you're stating is extremely flawed when you look at the primary evidence, sir.
If you say so.
I really want to show you the.
We can have that conversation in private, because I need to hear that, because I don't know of anything that's flawed in that. I don't know. And it's pretty simple, right? It's pretty basic stuff, and we talked about it. And, you know, these conversations are on tape.
No, look, I will be more than happy to go through a whole bunch of things with you about what you just said. Anytime, I'll do it on the air. I'll do it privately, anywhere. Seriously, I'm always happy to do this, and I will just point you in the direction of some things you can observe for yourself. Don't believe me. Look at the evidence. There's a whole lot of problems there. Marita Lorenz, the concept of Hunt being there, these three tramps, all this stuff is no good, and I'm sorry. St. John Hunt
Look, none of that is – look, you can't dispute the fact that there was nobody – and all these people got arrested, and there was no record of any of the arrests. You can't dispute that.
You haven't been through the Dallas police archives, because guess what? There are records of many arrests that day if you read them.
So they wouldn't give them to Garrison.
They wouldn't give them to Garrison. That's right. Garrison had a lot of resistance, but today you can actually see that those records have existed this whole time, even though they were tampered with.
And hang on.
Yeah.
What did you say, tampered with? Garrison thought they gave him one arrest, and he looked at it and said, this is a red herring. This is garbage. This is something that you're handing to me to mislead me. This is a piece of garbage that you have created.
And it's amazing that he came as close to the truth as he did with the interference, the disruption of his investigation, the infiltration of his investigation. It's amazing that he came up with even a single fact based on all the influence and distraction and destruction that was given to him by the Central Intelligence Agency directly in addition to others.
Okay, commercial break has started.
Yes, okay. Well, I guess we'll be right back unless we're off the air already. Danny?
HempUSA.org introduces three brand new detox formulations of micro plant powder. Brain Fuel for depression, bipolar disorders, and stress. Total Care, anti-cancer agent that cleans the liver and organs and increases memory. Rejuvenate, invigorates and heals the body, mind, and spirit. These products are your alternative to pharmaceuticals. Call 888-910-4367 and like us on Facebook. We ship worldwide. Only at HempUSA.org.
American Freedom Radio is back. We're trying to become commercial free, apart from a few honourable advertisers that we would give ad space to even if they couldn't pay us. In this quest to deliver quality radio with very few annoying ads, we are now asking the listeners like you to open up and become partners with American Freedom Radio. We all know the economy is controlled, and a new system called the peer-to-peer economy is now within our grasp. That means if you'd like this network with its incredible hosts and credible information to be nothing but the content you want to hear, then you must realize that you cannot be a part of it if you're just sitting on the sidelines watching. Go to AmericanFreedomRadio.com and pledge your support today. Donate according to your means. Some can only afford $1 a month, while others can afford $100 a month. Regardless of the size of your contribution, it all adds up to keeping the network owners and the radio hosts housed and fed at the end of every month. Thank you.
We are living in a new era. Partnerships are more important than profit, and gratitude is more respected than greed. As the millennial generation evolves the corporate landscape, our company aims to maximize the achievements of CBD application and push the limits of what's possible by 2020. Our core product matrix and careful cannabidiol purification process are uniquely designed to be privately made in different regions of the world and is geared to assist the efforts of different nations to change the landscape, various pain-related healthcare costs, epilepsy and autism, rising mental disorders, and even soldier suicides. Crystal Pure CBD is made with the industry's finest 99.9% pure CBD crystals. No paste, no filler. Our solution is a permanent answer, and it saves you over one-third in cost. Crystal Pure CBD. Come join us.
You're listening to AmericanFreedomRadio.com, the network who perseveres in delivering intelligent debate, constructive dialogue with true independence. The freedom to broadcast the truth is not free at all. So what is American Freedom Radio worth to you? The empowering information with fun, honest and pure integrity behind it provides an example to follow. Friendships to flourish with the moral altruism that pulls no punches. The hosts sacrifice and show remarkable discipline in their duty to deliver quality radio in service to the community with strength, wisdom and loyalty. The founders of AFR wish to thank you personally for sharing your views and insights to make the best radio and alternative media. Now it's time for you to give something back and play a vital role in the future of America. Be as generous with us as we've been with you. Click on the donate banner at AmericanFreedomRadio.com or volunteer by emailing AmericanFreedomRadio.com. Vaccines, psychotropic drugs, and artillery batteries not included.
No rules. No rules. No taboo topics. No taboo topics. No fear of doom. No fear of doom. We are American Freedom Radio. American Freedom Radio.
Still, we're going into the second hour. This is not the Ocelli Effect, although you did hear the Ocelli Effect's theme music at the beginning of the hour. This hour, ladies and gentlemen, I am extremely, extremely excited to do this. And why? Because I think it's absolutely necessary. Dr. James Fetzer is with me today. He is the host of the Real Deal podcast. You might have heard of that one. You might have also seen some of his books, Murder in Dealey Plaza, Assassination Science, and I'm just talking about the JFK stuff. He's all over a whole lot of other conspiracies, etc., etc. James H. Fetzer is a name you should absolutely know, because he's out there and definitely speaking about a great many things of importance. Now, before we kick into the JFK discussion, I'm going to let Dr. Fetzer in on something that relates directly to him and something that happened recently. And by the way, Carmine Savastano is still with me, but Carmine, I want you to maintain your mute button for the moment, because I want to say something to Dr. Fetzer, which he might not be fully aware of. You were on Ground Zero Media recently, and that's Clyde Lewis's show. They're out of Portland, Oregon, okay? Terrestrial radio, all that. I kind of consider it the bridge between the alternative and the mainstream. Interesting show, and you were on there, and there was a bit of an argument which ensued between you and Clyde and all that. And, of course, listeners to the Vinny Eastwood show would be well aware of that situation because you discussed it there, and he is also on this very same network. Well, anyway, Dr. Fetzer, here's something that you might not have known. Actually, I was approached by the executive producer there at Ground Zero Radio, who is Ron Patton. He asked me quite bluntly, did I know anyone who could give a great presentation on whether the conspiratorial mindset regarding political events and things was a sane way to look at them. Now, I recalled in my mind that you have done an excellent presentation explaining how it is a whole lot more logical and sensible, okay, to consider that conspiracies are more likely responsible for earth-shattering events, pivotal events, assassinations, tremendously devastating events in our history, in our recent times, and, hey, current events as well, right? I recalled that you do an excellent presentation on that particular fact. So it was me who suggested that they get you to discuss that topic. Okay. Turned into something else, and I really hope that although you and I are going to have some disagreements here, and I'm sure you're aware of that because I was a guest on your show, I think in 2011, and had sort of had an email exchange prior to that explaining to you that I had disagreements with you about the assassination, but we both sort of respectfully understood that we had studied certain things ourselves individually, and hey, let's have the discussion. And we did that. So you can find that in Jim's archive somewhere, my name once. Okay. Is anything I'm saying a surprise to you, Jim?
I don't know. I mean, the thing with Clyde Lewis took a curve when it got into my then new book, and I suppose we didn't go to the moon either, which addresses the moon landing hoax, the Paul McCartney's death and replacement, the first death of Saddam Hussein, the second death of Osama bin Laden, and the Holocaust. And it was the latter that generated a tremendous response from Clyde. And, you know, he had someone call in and so forth. They got to be fairly heated and intense. But, you know, I think addressing the rationality of conspiracy reasoning is a perfectly legitimate question. It's all a function of the evidence and the circumstances. And in the case of the Warren Report, for example, the CIA invented the phrase conspiracy theorist to try to put a spin on critics of the Warren Commission. Now, they were simply observing that things didn't add up, that the backyard photographs of Lee Oswald, for example, were seriously flawed and obviously fake, that the Mannlicher Carcano would have been a ridiculous choice for an assassination weapon, that the specific example they had blaming on Oswald was in terrible condition. It had a rusty mechanism. It was very difficult to work the bolt alone. And that shooting location was really preposterous, where Gunny Carlos Hathcock, who was the best sniper in the Marine Corps, for example, sought to reconstruct the shooting in Quantico and discovered that he couldn't do it, and reasoned quite appropriately that if he couldn't do it, that a guy who, you know, was a mediocre shot couldn't have done it. And, of course, we know today the whole thing was an elaborate charade that the Secret Service set him up. There are more than 15 indications that the driver, actually William Grimm, brought the limousine to a halt in Dealey Plaza to make sure he would be killed. He'd already been hit twice, once in the back, 5.5 inches below the collar to the right of the spinal column by a shot fired from the top of the county records building by, apparently by a Dallas deputy sheriff by the name of Harry Weatherford. He had been already shot in the throat by around the pass through the windshield from the triple underpass, apparently by an Air Force expert by the name of Jack Lawrence. And after the limo was brought to a halt, he was hit at least twice in the head, once in the back of the head, by a shot fired from the Daltex, apparently by an anti-Castro Cuban by the name of Nestor Tony Escadro, who was using the only unsilenced weapon, which was in fact a Mannlicher Carcano, where he fired three shots to set up the acoustical impression of only three shots having been fired, where one of the shots hit Jack in the back of the head. He slumped forward. Jackie eased him back up and was looking him right in the face when he was hit in the vicinity of the right temple by a frangible exploding bullet that was fired from the intersection of the triple underpass and the picket fence, apparently by Frank Sturgis, who would later be arrested in New York City by a Gold Shield detective of my acquaintance, Jim Rothstein, when he came there to murder Marita Lawrence to ensure she didn't testify before the HSCA. And when he entered Marita's apartment, Rothstein put a .38 to his head and took him into custody. And while they were conversing, he used a throwaway line, "Nice shooting." And Sturgis admitted that he had shot JFK, that he'd been aiming for his eye, but that he'd moved ever so slightly and he wound up hitting his temple, and that he'd done it because he believed that Jack had betrayed the brigade at the Bay of Pigs, and that he'd been comporting with beautiful women, some of whom were spies for other countries, in particular East Germany. And the former was false, but the latter was true. And Sturgis felt he had a just cause for participating in the assassination. There were several other shooters I've identified. Altogether, there were at least six and possibly seven, eight, nine, or ten shots were fired, and we can go wherever you want about that. But, you know, the Clyde Lewis thing was very, very interesting. I'd never encountered him before, and, you know, it was quite an intense exchange.
Oh, that's for sure. And, of course, this is the scenario which you talk about regarding the Kennedy assassination. I'm wondering, Carmine, do you have anything that you'd like to say regarding what we just heard? Because Jim has stuck to, you know, this particular scenario that he has in mind for quite a while. And, you know, the Clyde Lewis thing, I was just making that note that, that I, you know, in all good faith, I felt that I was suggesting you to go and discuss a topic which wound up not getting discussed once the third rail of the Holocaust and that kind of got hit regarding anything that's on terrestrial or mainstream or even remotely mainstream media. You know that that's just one of those areas that nobody touches over there. So that's just what happened, and that's why it devolved into what it did.
Well, actually, you know, to follow further on your question about conspiracy theorists, I mean, when there are massive gaps in the evidence like that, criticizing the government's account is a perfectly rational thing to do. In fact, if you only knew the information I've already imparted, it would be obvious that there had been multiple shooters and therefore a conspiracy. But the CIA wanted to find a use of language that would convert the burden of proof from the government, which after all had the obligation to prove its case against Lee Oswald as a lone assassin, onto the critics of the government. And by using the phrase conspiracy theorist, they made it sound as though critics of the government bore the burden of proving every aspect of their alternative account. when all they were actually doing was very reasonably observing that the government's narrative doesn't add up. And we have found that again and again with regard to 9/11. I founded Scholars for 9/11 Truth in December 2005. In the case of Wellstone, I had published 10 articles in an alternative newspaper before I would publish a co-authored book on his death. That was a small-scale conspiracy to eliminate the major critic of the Bush-Cheney administration who had opposed the war on Iraq, where he'd been warned just days before by Dick Cheney that if he opposed him on Iraq, there'd be severe ramifications for him personally and for the state of Minnesota. What could be more severe than taking him and his wife and, one or two of his kids out on the plane, as well as one or two aides and the two pilots? I mean, that was a small scale. Then Sandy Hook, my God, I've just published a new book about Sandy Hook. And we were doing extremely well. It appeared on the 22nd of October. It already had about 80 reviews, which split into a bimodal distribution, meaning you had a whole lot of five-star reports and a whole lot of one-star reports. But the difference was those who authored the five-star reviews had actually read the book, and those who put up the one-star reviews had not. I had 12 contributors, including a half a dozen current or retired university professors with PhDs and other experts on the case. And apparently the book was just too good because Amazon took it down on Thursday after I had a bizarre pseudo-interview with a person representing themselves as Inside Edition, but which appears to be have been an intel agency that was trying to probe for the power and the quantity of evidence we'd accumulated. And I think they concluded that it was just too much and that this book delegitimized the Obama administration. It connects Eric Holder and the president to the events of Sandy Hook, where we had a massive corruption by local parties pretending to be parents, by the teachers, the school board, by the local police, the state police, the medical examiner of the state, the governor of the state. I mean, the den of iniquity is vast, but 425 pages later, there's really no doubt about it. And then, of course, the Boston bombing, which I regard as one of the most amateurish false flag attacks ever perpetrated anywhere, unless you want to go, say, to the Virginia shooting, where the marksman, you know, walks up to them. He's a great big black guy, but they don't notice. It's on a wooden walkway. You would have heard the creaking. The cameraman's looking away, waits till the cameraman looks around, and he points at the female reporter and shoots her point blank, but there's no ejection of shells. There's no blood on the body. She runs away, and later we do an aerial shot. There's no blood at all. I mean, that was extremely amateurish. And, of course, we have the shooting in Charleston that also appears to have been a fraud. The purported shooter was wearing a jacket to which apartheid patches had been added by Photoshop. And we have video of him entering the church at 0800, but somebody didn't understand a 24-hour clock and thought that was 8 p.m. when it was 8 a.m. The shooting of these black people in the church would have been quite a horrific scene. The pews would have been shot up and splintered, blood all over the place, the altar no doubt a shambles. He reportedly reloaded repeatedly, and yet they held a perfectly normal church service within 48 hours. Out in Oregon, another fantasy scenario where you have this guy who allegedly is asking students if they're Christians and then shooting them in the head. I mean, these psyops are very cleverly designed in the case of Sandy Hook to instill fear into parents, in the case of Charleston to instill fear into blacks, in the case of the Umpqua shooting in Oregon to instill fear into Christians. Well, there are quite a few parents, blacks and Christians in this country. So the whole idea was try to get us in a state of anxiety over guns to promote the Obama administration's gun control agenda, which, frankly, on the face of it, is simply absurd. If, for example, we wind up in a war with Russia, which the neocons surrounding Obama are intent on bringing about, including Susan Rice, his national security advisor, Samantha Power, his ambassador to the United Nations, Victoria Nuland, his assistant secretary of state for Middle Eastern Affairs, Ashton Carter, his secretary of defense. They all want to provoke a war with Russia. Well, let us assume that happens. Washington is almost certainly going to be annihilated. Our government's going to collapse. Where are the American people going to be if they have no guns? The NRA made the point a long time ago that when guns are outlawed, only outlaws will have guns. Criminals don't obey the law, and they're certainly not going to obey laws that require them to surrender their weapons. So this is bizarre. The idea of having citizen soldiers is, embedded in the Constitution and the Second Amendment, and were it not the case, we would not have been able to defeat the British at Concord and Lexington.
Right. Jim, I would like to I let you speak there, and I appreciate a lot of the different views that you had there. Don't want to sit and talk about all of that actually though, because we'd have a limited amount of time, and I'd like to stick to the narrow topic of the Kennedy assassination, if you don't mind.
Well, sure, but you were asking me, about whether conspiracy.
I understand.
Are rational, and I was inventorying a series of cases in which concluding that we have been duped and a conspiracy was involved is manifest.
Well, right, and you know what? Even if you assume that 20% of what you said was correct, you're still right about the fact that, and this is why I said it was completely valid, the presentation that you had done, even without citing all of these different events and occasions. It's quite valid to assume that things in human history are accomplished by groups of individuals, not by lone individuals, not as random occurrences, but as intentional acts.
That conspiracy is the most frequently prosecuted crime in the United States. It just takes two or more individuals coordinating together to bring about an illegal end. Most conspiracies are economic or financial. Right. One of the reasons for 9/11 was to destroy all the documents and records of the Security and Exchange Administration that were located in Building 7, which everyone knows was not hit by any plane, had no jet fuel-based fires, and collapsed 7 hours after the Twin Towers had been destroyed in what was obviously a controlled demolition. So,
right,
I'll go wherever you would like to go, and I appreciate your featuring me, so lay on.
No, I appreciate it. It's just I would like to try and limit, only because of the amount of time that we have, I would like to limit the discussion to the Kennedy assassination. That's the only thing that I'm trying to do here. So I do apologize. And I'm willing to discuss all these topics with you at a later date, but it's just today I would like to focus on.
Well, you mentioned, too, I engage in collaborative research on all of these subjects. When I founded Scholars for 9/11 Truth, it was bring together pilots, physicists, engineers, architectural, civil, mechanical, aeronautical. When I did my JFK research, I began by putting together people who knew, had expertise in areas I did not. For example, David W. Mandick, MD, PhD, the first individual with whom I suggested we collaborate on a long article or a short book. And David is not only a PhD in physics, he's an MD and also an expert board certified in radiation oncology, which is a treatment of X-rays of cancer using X-ray therapy. So he was an expert on the interpretation of X-rays. And when he entered the National Archives at the end of 1992, he discovered immediately that the lateral cranial X-ray of JFK, that is of the skull taken from the side, in this case the right side, had been altered to conceal a massive blowout to the back of the head the size of your fist. But they used material that was much too dense to be human bone. And when he delineated the area, it had a very distinct character that's significant, because I would subsequently discover that when they altered the Zapruder film to conceal the blowout, they overlooked a frame 374 where you can actually see the blowout. And when you compare the area in which David had discovered the patch had occurred, it's very close proximity to the actual blowout, as you can see in frame 374. And that another X-ray, the anterior, posterior, or front to rear, had been altered by adding a 6.5-millimeter metallic slice, which was intended to implicate this odd-caliber Mannlicher Carcano, one of the worst military weapons ever designed by the hand of man. In fact, it was known as the humanitarian rifle in World War II for never harming anyone on purpose. So that's why they had to create this mail order thing to frame Oswald. They had to have a paper trail. He could have obtained a far superior weapon on any street corner in Dallas without having to even produce any ID.
Oh, right, and that whole paper trail related to the weapon is garbage, and you know, just bluntly, there's nothing to it. You know, you can't have Railway Express delivering things to a post office. That's nonsense. Imagine UPS dropping things off at a post office. I got you there, but you know, Carmine, I know you were trying to say something before. Did you want to introduce something into the discussion here?
Sure. I would say that while we all might agree that there was a conspiracy, that the preponderance of evidence does suggest a conspiracy, I think some of the details, though, we might disagree on. Just I think that that number of shooters seems quite high. I think that it would be a smaller number of shooters.
Well, I proved it already. I proved 8 in 10 shots already in Assassination Science. There's a chapter there where I just give an argument by addition or subtraction. Because Jack had 4 hits all by himself. Connolly was hit 1 to 3 times, and we have at least 3 shots that missed. One that hit a curbing and injured the distant bystander James Tague. One that was picked up in the grass opposite the grassy knoll. And a third that hit the chrome strip over the windshield. So 4 plus 3 plus 3, 8, 9, or 10, depending how many were fired at Connolly. But, you know, I mean, the magic bullet theory is, of course, preposterous. I already mentioned where Jack was hit in the back, and, of course, he was hit in the throat. So when they discovered that their official 3-shot scenario with 3 hits, which the FBI and the Secret Service agreed upon already the day of the shooting, namely that Jack had been hit in the back, Connolly had been hit in the back, and then Jack had been hit in the back of the head, when it turned out that James Tague had been injured, they had to subtract 1 and be very creative by moving the wound to the back, up to the uppermost back initially, and then Gerald Ford had it moved to the base of the back of the neck. So they could account for the wound to the throat as an exit wound, then going into the back of John Connolly. Here we have the magic bullet. But we have the shirt, the jacket, the autopsy report, Siebert O'Neill, 2 FBI reports about the location of the wound. We have a reenactment by the staff that shows a big patch on the back, 5.5 inches below the collar, as I describe, a smaller one on the back of the head, so that my favorite photograph of all is the young Arliss Specter holding a pointer showing the trajectory the magic bullet would have had to have taken if that hypothesis were true. And you look below his hand about 4 or 5 inches and you see the patch on the back of the stand-in for Jack, which means that a photograph intended to illustrate the magic bullet actually refutes it. And when you take into account the mortician's description, who spent more time with the body than anyone else, he said there was a wound to the back between, 5 and 6 inches below the collar. And that's absolutely right. And, of course, he knew that he had actually witnessed Commander Humes taking a cranial saw to the skull of JFK to enlarge in that fist-sized wound that 6, 7, or 8 physicians at Parkland all described in order to make it look more like something that could have been fired from behind. You may argue with me about the details, but I tell you, I've done 1,000 interviews on this. I've got the 3 books. There's a 3rd book, The Great Zapruder Film Hoax. I've been working with the best people in the world on this, and I think you're going to have a hard time proving I have something wrong.
Well, I think that despite any disagreements we may have, that I agree at least in the fact that I think we can all agree there was a cover-up, and because there was a cover-up, and that basically for most of the primary evidence has been established in some for some reason there was a cover-up, it is now the exact reasoning that has to be proven with the primary evidence. And I just think there's a lot of things that aren't necessarily as in stone as anyone might think. I think that everything is open to, and not only interpretation, but to new evidence, because there are millions of files and no one has gone through them all.
Well, I'll grant you that new evidence can make a difference, because Larry Rivera, with whom I collaborate, where I do a new JFK show every Wednesday, the real deal is Monday, Wednesday, Friday from 7 to 9 Central, 8 to 10 Eastern, and the second hour of every Wednesday is devoted to the new new JFK show. And Larry has, he and I and Gary King traveled to Dallas. We actually did a better job of figuring out where the shot that passed through the windshield had been fired from, which was actually inside the triple underpass, where there's a big it's like an electrical box there where you could stash the rifle after taking the shot, but because the inclination of the street, which is about 11 degrees, that is the trajectory that works. I know two other shooters. One was Roscoe White, who was on the grassy knoll, fired a shot, which I believe he pulled because he would have hit Jackie, which is the round that was picked up in the grass. And then Malcolm Mack Wallace was firing from the book depository, not the east side. No one was firing from the alleged assassin's lair, but from the west, at John Conley, in the mistaken belief that it was Ralph Yarborough. LBJ and Jack had a huge argument that morning where Lyndon was trying to get his close friend and former political campaign manager John Conley out of the car, and Ralph Yarborough, a liberal Texas senator whom he despised, into the car, but where Jack overrode him on the ground that the chief executive of the state ought to ride with the chief executive of the United States. Now, David Mantic, who's the leading expert on the medical evidence in the world today, has just published a new book about the JFK skull x-rays, where I was flattered to write the introduction to the book. And he suggests there may have been yet a third shot to the head, which it would seem to me would have come perhaps from the vicinity of the pergola. But I have, and David had yet to be more specific about it, just he finds indications that there's yet a third shot to the head.
Jim, let me throw something at you for your consideration, okay? Sure. A lot of this is based on the fact that evidence has been tampered with, this, and absolutely fabricated, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, that's the truth of a lot of the assertions that you're making and requiring all these other shots. What about the work of somebody like Sherry Feaster, okay, who has taken a look at this through the lens of more modern forensic techniques and examined the evidence that is publicly available, okay, and has essentially demonstrated with techniques which were not even utilized at the time, like, for instance, beveling and bone is now not considered to be a standard for the determining trajectory of a missile, okay, as it once was. It's not definitive any longer if you check with the textbooks now, okay? Things like this, where if you apply it to the existing evidence that we've all been able to access, okay, through the Fox set of photographs, and not the reproductions, but I mean a good original set of them, as well as, the x-rays which have made their ways out, things like this, okay? If you take a look at that stuff and you line it up with more modern forensic techniques which have improved over time, you can prove shots from two different directions. You can prove a conspiracy without altering the Zapruder film, without altering the autopsy evidence, without creating a whole lot of these other scenarios. And by the way, Frank Sturgis would tell you that he was God himself if he got a chance, as far as I can understand. So I really don't take anything that man ever said seriously. Roscoe White,
debunked in the 90s by Harold Weisberg.
I mean, Jim Mars and I both agree that Roscoe White actually was a stand-in for Lee Oswald in the backyard photographs. He's got the right kind of chin. The backyard photographs have the wrong chin. There's an insert line between the chin and the lower lip. The chin is a block chin like Roscoe White's chin, not the pointed chin like Lee Oswald. The fingertips of the right hand are cut off. He's holding a new communist newspaper, The Worker and the Militant, with known dimension. Jack White used them as an internal ruler to determine that the individual in the photograph was only about 5'6", whereas Lee was around 5'10", or else that when they introduced the newspapers, they put them in a little too large, which is the more likely explanation. But the fact is that, there are multiple backyard photographs. Everyone has exactly the same face with exactly the same features and expression, which is impossible if they actually were taken, at different times and positions. But is exactly what Lee said it was. Someone had pasted his face on someone else's body. And what Jim noticed was that the arm, the right arm, has this funny little bump. And it just so turns out that Roscoe White has the same funny little bump. So, you guys can speculate all you want. I'll tell you, Sherry Feaster does not impress me. She's doing an analysis of the Zapruder film, which is fake. The blood was painted in. that John Costella has done the best work in the world on the Zapruder film. He's the leading expert. I have a huge amount of his stuff. In the third book, which you did not mention, The Great Zapruder Film Hoax, published in 2003. So, you know, I think you're just beating your gums. I mean, you're not telling me anything that impresses me at all.
And that's fine, but the point isn't to impress you, Mr. Fetzer. The point is that the evidence is required to be able to prove these things. You're saying these things with such certainty and definitiveness.
But they have been proven, for God's sake. Have you not read my books? I brought together the best people on different aspects.
So that they can
I brought together the best people on different aspects of the assassination in all three books. Sherry Feister. I've seen her presentations, and they're frankly amateurish and insignificant. Now, what you're ignoring too is that Larry Rivera rediscovered the press.
So that would be her ignoring your credentials, which doesn't make any sense.
Look, we've already established the blood splatter was painted in, for God's sake.
Well, that
how can she do an analysis of blood splatter when it's painted into the film?
All right, let me ask you this. How is that?
You guys need to put your thinking caps on because this is just silly.
I'm asking a question. How is that established? I'm putting my thinking cap on.
John Costella took it apart already. Have you not studied his work on the Zapruder film? In that case, you're ignorant, massively ignorant.
Insults are not required, and you are just making yourself look childish by using them.
This is just silly.
But if you want to be able to prove what you have to say, then it requires...
Every single thing I've said has been proven. It's been reinforced by Doug Horn in his massive 5-volume Inside the ARRB, published in 2009. I'm sorry, but you guys just aren't that familiar with the evidence. It's very disappointing.
I have a copy of that at my feet. I'm quite familiar with Costello's work. I'm extremely familiar with the film. I'm extremely familiar with all the assertions you're making. What I'm saying is that these things are all subject to interpretation. I don't think that Costello has definitively proven his assertions. Okay, that is what I see based on the fact that I've seen that film broken down by more than one person over the years, and I do know that Costello has done his work. I've taken a look at his analysis of the sign, the movement, and the changes of things, the different ways that when one stabilizes the film. I even have placed on my YouTube channel the Costello version of the Zapruder film because it's one of the clearest and cleanest things available on the internet. Okay. Don't tell me I'm not familiar. I'm telling you that regardless of who it is that you put together, some of them are the best people in the field, but it doesn't mean that they have come up with a scientifically provable answer to some of these questions.
But that's what we do. We apply scientific principles, scientific reasoning to the evidence. That's what I am. I'm a professional philosopher of science. That's why the name of the first book is Assassination Science, 1998. We were applying scientific techniques of the X-rays, discovering the alteration, the massive blowout concealed to the addition of the 6.5-millimeter metallic slice. Bob Livingston, world authority on the human brain, expert on wound ballistics, contributed his analysis. The brain shown in diagrams and photographs, National Archives can't possibly be that of JFK. He had about half his brains blown out in Dealey Plaza. It's a complete brain, virtually, showing an intact cerebellum, but the physicians at Parkland, one after another, reported cerebellar as well as cerebral tissue extruding from that wound. What's most interesting is when you have a true hypothesis, you get more evidence that supports it. In the case of the alteration of the Zapruder film, for example, Larry Rivera has rediscovered interviews done by Fred Newcomb with the motorcycle escort officers and their supervisor, Travis Ellis, which Newcomb recorded in 1971. Stabbers. And it turns out that based upon their reports, that after he was hit so hard with debris that he initially thought he himself had been shot, Officer Hargis, riding to the left rear, dismounted his motorcycle, ran between the two limousines up to the grassy knoll because he believed that was the location of the shooter. Officer Douglas Jackson motored his bike up the grassy knoll until it fell over, then proceeded on foot
Meanwhile, five agents in the Secret Service Cadillac dismounted, surrounded the presidential limousine. One took a piece of skull from a little boy, threw it in the back seat. All this taking place while Clint Hill rushes up the back of the trunk. Jackie's going after this chunk of JFK's skull and brains, pushes her back in the seat, lies across him, and peers into this gaping fist-sized wound at the back of JFK's head. Recognizing the man's already dead, he turns and gives his colleagues a thumb down, all before the limousine takes off for Parkland. Now, I had originally surmised, because we had like 60 witnesses to the vehicle either dramatically slowing or coming to a complete halt, where it dramatically slowed as it came to a complete halt, that it might have been 6 or 8 seconds. Now, however, with this new information, it seems to me it had to be 20 or 30 seconds. They did a massive excising of the film. They did it using optical printing and special effects. It was done at Hawkeye Work. We know that the original was taken at the National Photographic Interpretation Center already on Saturday. It was an 8mm already split film that had been developed in Dallas. They began briefing boards for an unspecified individual, head of the CIA, FBI, maybe even Johnson himself. Sunday, however, they brought the substitute film. It was a 16mm unsplit film from Hawkeye Works in Rochester, New York. An agent who identified himself as William Smith brought it, and they created a whole second set of briefing boards. Now, you can read all about it in Doug Horn's book, because he inventories all this in detail. I mean,
and I
Doug
read
did a
every
really
volume,
thorough
yes.
job.
Personally,
I prefer to only read primary evidence. I don't read a lot of people's books because I find that interpretation and sometimes ideas which can't be proven are often in them.
Well,
he puts all the primary evidence in the book.
Look,
this is a little bizarre to me.
Look, I read all of Doug Horn's books. I'm quite aware of what you're talking about. Okay? Quite aware of it. But I'm also aware that they are not the complete interviews. He gives you excerpts of various things in there, and I do understand what his hypothesis is. I understand how he supported it. Dino Brugioni, you know, the whole thing about what happened with Hawkeye Works, the fact that there is an unsplit film showing up after the film has been split, et cetera, et cetera. I'm aware of all this. But you see, what happens here is you're giving a barrage of things which contain a whole lot of assertions, all right, based on somebody else's observations without actually talking about the primary witnesses, the primary documentation, the primary artifacts, okay? Like, for instance, I contend that the primary Zapruder film doesn't exist. I believe it's been altered, damaged, and screwed with, that's for sure, okay? You know, sorry to put it that way, but that is the truth. Okay. Now, as to the nature of that, there are many stories which have circulated. I mean, I'm well familiar with David Lifton having looked into this as well. I'm well familiar with all this. I've watched many, many hours of the things that you have presented. I'm well aware of it. But the thing is, when you go on these long kind of tangents, you can't even get into the discussion of what's real about these things. I simply asserted to you a question, which was, if we just base it on the evidence which is easily observable without going down all these rabbit trails, you have the evidence for conspiracy in hand already. What about that?
And well, do you want the truth, the whole truth, or nothing but the truth? I mean, if you're talking about drawing inferences from a fabricated film, yes, of course it shows conspiracy, because you got the violent back and to the left. But no one in Dealey Plaza observed that violent back and to the left, not one person. And that's because it was an artifact of the way they edited the film. They merged the two hits I've described here. So you only have one frame of the head moving forward from the shot to the back of the head. And they put it, then Jack, after Jackie eased him back up and he was hitting the right temple, he slumped to the left. But they took out so many frames that it created this violent back and to the left that nobody saw at Dealey Plaza. So, you know, if you guys want to play amateur hour, you know, and say, well, what are the simplest and easiest inferences to draw if you just assume the evidence is authentic, have at it. That's not my business. My business is getting down to the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. The elaborate alteration of the film, we have massive evidence of it. I was seeking to explain it because I thought, naively, you wanted me to come on and explain the results of our research, which I've been attempting to do.
Well, to respond to that, the primary evidence is what is legally admissible. So if we ever really want to prove anything, it's going to require a preponderance of primary evidence. It's not going to require just assertions that
and
may
what
or may
do you
not
think,
be true.
I would ask you
to allow me to speak, please. When you get enough primary evidence, then you have a legally actionable case that could be brought to a court, much like the MLK case was in 99, and you could get a judgment that could prove conspiracy.
Do you think James Earl Ray shot Martin Luther King?
No,
Sirhan Sirhan shot Bobby?
No,
Both cases went to trial. Do you think Sirhan Sirhan shot Bobby?
I do not think that
they went to trial. Sirhan was convicted. Do you believe Sirhan shot Bobby?
They went to trial, sir, but those things can't be overturned if new evidence.
The point I am making is the evidence shows Bobby was hit four times from the back. He was shot behind the right ear from an inch and a half. Sirhan never got anywhere near him, was firing from in front. Sirhan was a clear distraction, but Sirhan was convicted in a court of law. So I think you have the wrong standard.
No. Well, that's fine that we disagree on our standards, but I'm just saying what is going to go down in the history books is going to have to be in a legal setting. It can't just be people all agreeing outside of the courts.
Where is the legal case involving JFK's assassination?
In my opinion, the legal case is that we now know, based on modern developments, that, for instance, something I was glad to contribute was some of the decoding of cryptonyms. I was happy to help prove that Guy Bannister was, in fact, a CIA informant, that Jack Ruby was an FBI informant of not much use, but he was one. I think that all those things further lend to a preponderance of evidence.
Well, Lee Oswald was an informant for the FBI. He had informant number 179. He was being paid $200 a month right up to the assassination.
But that was just a claim by a reporter. And
no, it isn't. That was a finding of the Attorney General of Texas, Wagoner Carr.
Wagoner Carr heard that from...
He didn't hear that. He found it out.
Why do you think we can't get the W-2 forms for
the alleged assassin of the President of the United States? Because they would show he was being paid as an FBI informant.
I'm not saying that any of those things are not possible, but there is no solid evidence that that is true. There is evidence that in the back rooms of the DPD, there was all sorts of ideas and theories flying around that the DA and others picked up and ran with. So we can't say that he for sure was. If anything, I think that it's more likely, based on some of the primary evidence where Thomas Kasason talks about perhaps using Oswald when he gets back from Minsk, that the CIA would have a much better chance of having Oswald on a string rather than the FBI.
And let me just ask you one thing.
Lee had a long history of involvement with the intelligence agencies. He appears to have been recruited by ONI when he was in recruit training in San Diego. He appears to have been sent to Monterey to study the Russian language. He was stationed at Atsugi, our most highly classified base, the source of the U-2 overflights. He had radar information. The Russians knew they were taking place. They didn't know the altitude. They couldn't shoot him down. He does a pseudo-defection to the Soviet Union. There's about to be a summit meeting between Eisenhower and Khrushchev that would reduce Cold War tensions. Instead, Khrushchev accuses Eisenhower of spying on the Soviet Union. Eisenhower denies it, and Khrushchev parades Francis Gary Powers and parts of the U-2, which Lee may very well have contributed to shooting down. In other words, was sent there on a mission by the CIA because they wanted to abort the summit. Fletcher Prouty has an alternative theory that they had actually shorted the gas tank in the U-2 so that the plane would be destined to come down in any case, but he didn't take his cyanide tablet, and they had him. It embarrassed the United States and elevated Cold War tensions rather than reducing them. When Lee returns to the United States, having married the daughter of a KGB colonel, he's met by a CIA front organization, given money to help relocate here in the United States. He winds up in New Orleans. He's working with David Ferry and with Judith Ferry Baker under the supervision of Dr. Mary Sherman to develop rapid acting cancer.
Okay.
Chuck,
now,
Go ahead.
You're kidding me. Listen, Jim.
I'm completely serious.
No. Please.
Ed Haslam is documented in Dr. Mary's Monkey. Judith's written a book about it, me and Lee.
Without any documentation or any sort of...
there's voluminous documentation. You have your head where the sun doesn't shine. It's embarrassing.
I don't really
get the point of this.
No. Hey, I was going to ask you a legitimate question, but I mean, please don't interrupt.
I have yet to hear it.
Baker.
I have yet to hear a legitimate question.
Really, I asked you a simple question about the way, that you could perceive the evidence without having to go into all of these other side issues and details of things that are difficult or impossible to prove. Judith Ary Baker has zero evidence of anything. And in fact,
I've read her book. I don't believe it because it's just chock full of evidence. She had friends who co-dated with her and Lee. I mean, you really off the mark.
It's
embarrassing. She knew Jack Ruby down there as Sparky Rubenstein.
Sparky Rubenstein.
Which there is absolutely no proof of. All the famous people she has claimed to know, Carlos Marcello, Jack Ruby, yes. Clay Shaw, David Ferry. There is no proof whatsoever, including if you look at Lee Harvey Oswald's diary, which discusses almost every woman he ever encountered in Russia.
Ed Haslam vetted Judah's story, and Ed is as careful and meticulous as anyone out here.
And
why don't we go back to other aspects? We're obviously not going to agree
about I would like to drop the Judith Ary Baker thing off because it's going to go nowhere, please. Okay, that's all I'm asking here, if we can just leave that one alone, okay? Because we're not going to agree.
Can I get a couple of questions on that?
Sure, I guess so. If Jim is up for it, I don't want to press him into something he doesn't want to do. Absolutely not. Jim,
else if you guys want to.
Jim, are you up for something from Carmine?
I don't care. You guys can ask anything you want.
Okay. Go ahead, Carmine.
My question. Oswald was under repeated surveillance, as can be verified by the primary evidence that I don't think any of us are in disagreement with. He was under repeated surveillance by the CIA with the mail program, where they were monitoring his mail and monitoring his family's mail. He was under surveillance by the FBI in various places. Even his Aunt Lillian Moret informed the Bureau about him before the assassination. Yet none of them ever saw him with Baker. He never makes a single notation in his own personal diary about her.
That's just wrong, to the best of my knowledge. That's just wrong. But if we are going to go up a blind alley with Judith, then go back to something else. Let's talk about this. Lee told Will Fritz that he was out with Bill Shelley in front during the shooting. In the James Ike Elchin's photograph, known as the Elchin Six, there's a figure in the doorway that looks striking like Lee Oswald.
Some of us have done
a great deal of research. Yeah. He's the right height, the right weight, the right build. He's wearing the right clothing to have been Lee Oswald. Similar height, similar weight, similar build, similar shirt, similar T-shirt. The claim is made it was Billy Lovelady. Billy himself said he was 2 to 3 inches shorter, 15 to 20 pounds heavier, and he was actually standing beside Lee holding his hands up to protect them from the sun, wearing a short sleeve, red and white, vertically striped shirt. When the FBI asked him to come in on 29 February 1964 to show them the shirt he had been wearing, it was a short-sleeve, red and white, vertically striped shirt. Now, the evidence in terms of the body, the size, the shape, the clothing, the build and all that overwhelmingly favors Lee Oswald. It excludes Billy Lovelady. There's a third figure has been brought in who looks like a gorilla. I have referred to him as the Gorilla Man. He's got a shirt that's red and black checked that's buttoned up to the neck. But Doorman's shirt is splayed open. Totally different. Gorilla Man must weigh 50 pounds more than Doorman. Doesn't look anything like him. Just a simple argument by elimination establishes Doorman was Lee Oswald. Larry Rivera, same guy, has done some brilliant new research where he found photographs of both Billy and Lee at a similar angle to the angle of the doorman face when they were flipped. So he flipped both of them and created GIFs. And when you do the GIF to fill in the doorman image, it fits Lee Oswald like a glove. When you do the Billy Lovelady, there are all kinds of anomalies. I recently presented this on my Real Deal show, actually last Wednesday, which is absolutely fascinating. So anyone out there wants to see the latest proofs, Lee Oswald was in the doorway, as he told Will Fritz, which not only means he cannot have been the lone gunman, he can't even have been one of the shooters.
See, ten different assertions, though, that there's a problem with. You're basing the assertions of Will Fritz writing down these notes based on that crap that we've seen, which was typical of Fritz's note-taking, by the way, which are these sentence fragments written down. Okay? Then you're taking on the photograph, which wasn't even something that we were discussing, but okay. And then you wind up introducing a whole lot of things. It's like a giant filibuster.
Allow me to add.
There's nothing a filibuster. I'm trying to explain for the benefit of the public, since you guys obviously have your minds closed, what we've actually discovered.
Once again, no, it's not that our minds are closed. It's that we also are considering that the additional evidence that has been offered, such as none of the witnesses ever said that Oswald was on the stairs, such as Oswald himself in interviews, press interviews, said that he was inside the building. They said, "Were you inside the building?" He said, "Yes." He said, "Yes, I was inside the building during the shot."
For God's sake, you got a man the right height, the right build, the right weight,
and you have
the right clothing and the right face.
Don't know who they are. He could be any one of a number of witnesses.
Oh, you guys, this is really quite a waste. Let's find the quickest way to end this.
It's almost over.
This is a complete waste of time with the two of you, really, truly.
It's almost over.
It's unfortunate that you are so close-minded you can't consider other
people's ideas
and other primary evidence.
I'm close-minded to serious evidence of which you produce not one iota.
Excuse us? No, we produce things that people can verify. For instance, they can verify that
verify
none of the witnesses in any of the official reports ever said that
on this show that is not
verified.
I asked a question about the notes regarding Fritz, and a tirade ensues. I'm talking to you about those notes, which are fragmented sentences. Is that not what you're referring to?
Well,
and
sure.
Go
there
off
is,
on a, on
there
a personal
is his
attack.
Own handwriting on the Mary Farrell archives.
Right. Okay. So we are talking about the same thing. You're drawing an inference from that. Okay. Because it's a sentence fragment. It's a sentence fragment.
How can you not draw an inference? It's obvious when he says he was out with Bill Shelley in front. Is obviously the answer to the question, where were you during the shooting? And it turns out when you investigate, that's exactly where he was, out with Bill Shelley in front, because it was captured in a famous photograph by AP photographer James Ike Alchins.
Hey.
I can't believe the amount of evidence we've done. We have probably 30 articles about this. And I'm willing to bet neither of you have read any of them, not a single one.
Once again,
you lose.
I've read many of your articles on Veterans Today and in other places.
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
I have considered what you had to say. Now, we might
gather together the Oswald
what you had to say, but that does not necessarily rule out that which you do not say is going to be wrong. Primary evidence can be applied to anyone's arguments.
You know, where are you thinking you're getting this primary evidence? If the Fritz notes aren't primary evidence, what is?
No,
you know, all the X-rays have been altered.
If you're going to accept that primary evidence, you might also accept
the
primary evidence of witnesses saying that he wasn't on the stairs.
Here's a problem with your whole approach. Here's a problem with your whole approach. You're taking for granted the authenticity of what you're alluding to as primary evidence. Not one of the autopsy X-rays in the National Archives is the original.
I do believe that we might agree on some of the medical exhibits having been altered, not been originals, but I base that on the primary evidence. It's the testimony of people like Drs. Ebersole, Dr. Fink, Dr.
Ebersole has been responsible for altering the X-rays, for God's sake.
In your opinion, once again, we had 26 people in the autopsy room.
We got the deposition of Ebersole. It's in Assassination Science, and David annotated it, for God's sake.
Yeah, and that is, once again, an assertion. Does he have
assertions are simply saying things that are true or false. And, of course, I have to make assertions to explain what I'm talking about.
And that's fine.
So you're saying this is an assertion is silly. You can't have any proof of anything without premises.
None of our assertions are definitive without substantial evidence.
Oh, there's evidence substantiating every single thing I've said here tonight. Every single thing.
We disagree. Just as you disagree with the
I don't care if you disagree.
There's an interpretation.
You can believe whatever you want. I'm giving you the result of my work with the best experts for 20 years now.
And that's fine, but seniority doesn't necessarily denote that it's the better argument. It's based on the substantial evidence.
Right. You got the best research by the best experts on the medical evidence, on the Zapruder film, on the host of other issues. No, just discount it as you will. You can believe whatever you want. I'm explaining what I have done in accomplishing publishing these collections of expert studies.
Yes, Jim, listen, the one thing that we can agree on here is that it was not Oswald who was the lone shooter, and people need to examine the evidence for themselves and take a good look at it, don't you say?
Have a nice day, you guys. Real pleasure.
Thank you. Absolutely.
Nutritious food is real body armor. It builds muscle, burns fat, improves digestion, and feeds the entire body the nutrients it needs. Did you know the U.S. government banned the hemp plant from growing in the United States and classified it as a Schedule I drug to hide it behind the marijuana plant? People have been confused about this plant for over 80 years, and many still don't know what hemp is. So now you know hemp is not marijuana, and marijuana is not hemp. They are different varieties of the same species. HempUSA.org wants the world to know these basic facts and to help people understand that hemp protein powder is the best-kept health secret you need to know about. Remember, hemp protein powder contains 53% protein, is gluten-free, anti-inflammatory, non-GMO, and is loaded with nutrients. Call 888-910-4367, 888-910-4367, and see what our powder, seeds, and oil can do for you. Only at HempUSA.org.
What kind of person are you? How do you see yourself? Are you the kind of person that lets everyone else do all the work, just hoping that you'll be able to get some of the crumbs that fall from the table? Or are you the kind of person that rolls up their sleeves and does the dirty jobs that no one else wants to do? Are you hoping that all the activists giving their blood, sweat, and tears to serve humanity are going to solve all the world's problems? Or are you just wondering, is there something simple I can do to contribute? Yes. Yes, there is. Help us. Help us do what we do. Partner up with American Freedom Radio today by gifting a regular amount to support the network and your favorite hosts, bringing you less commercials and more information. Go to AmericanFreedomRadio.com and start donating today from between $1 and $100 per month, according to the kind of person you are. Thank you very much for your support.
We are living in a new era. Partnerships are more important than profit, and gratitude is more respected than greed. As the millennial generation evolves the corporate landscape, our company aims to maximize the achievements of CBD application and push the limits of what's possible by 2020. Our core product matrix and careful cannabidiol purification process are uniquely designed to be privately made in different regions of the world and is geared to assist the efforts of different nations to change the landscape for various pain-related healthcare costs, epilepsy and autism, rising mental disorders, and even soldier suicides. Crystal Pure CBD is made with the industry's finest 99.9% pure CBD crystals. No paste, no filler. Our solution is a permanent answer, and it saves you over one-third in cost. Crystal Pure CBD. Come join us.
You're listening to AmericanFreedomRadio.com, the network who perseveres in delivering intelligent debate, constructive dialogue with true independence. The freedom to broadcast the truth is not free at all. So what is American Freedom Radio worth to you? The empowering information with fun, honest, and pure integrity behind it provides an example to follow. Friendships to flourish with the moral altruism that pulls no punches. The hosts sacrifice and show remarkable discipline in their duty to deliver quality radio in service to the community with strength, wisdom, and loyalty. The founders of AFR wish to thank you personally for sharing your views and insights to make the best radio and alternative media. Now it's time for you to give something back and play a vital role in the future of America. Be as generous with us as we've been with you. Click on the donate banner at AmericanFreedomRadio.com or volunteer by emailing AmericanFreedomRadio.com. Vaccines, psychotropic drugs, and artillery batteries not included.
No rules. No rules. No taboo topics. No taboo topics. No fear of doom. No fear of doom. We are. We are. American Freedom Radio. American Freedom Radio.